Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 311 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the second part of a two-part interview, Richard Holmes speaks with Gabriel Badamosi about the intrusions and liberations of biographical research, shares some useful advice for aspiring biographers, and considers the impact of photography and the changing nature of biography as a form. You can hear the first part of this interview in the preceding episode, number 310.
"You've got to fall in love with the subject," says Richard Holmes, one of the great biographers of the Romantic poets Shelley and Coleridge. His subjects include a breathtaking range of artists, scientists and thinkers of the Romantic Revolution in thought and feeling, which occurred in the 18th and 19th centuries and which, he hopes, with a bit of luck, is still active in transforming our worldview today. The social and cultural revolutions of the 1960s strongly marked the beginnings of his vocation as a biographer. From early feminist Mary Wollstonecraft's vindication of the rights of women to astronomer William Herschel's discoveries of a new planet and other galaxies, Richard Holmes reaches out to connect their intellectual excitement to ours, the personalities then to the possibilities now. Biography, he says, tells you about your own life. I went to the British Library in London to speak with him. You describe another kind of quality of the biographer, in a sense, the biographer's potential for cruelty to the subject. So you draw variously images of yourself, perhaps, as a tramp who turns up at their houses, knocking on the door, trying to get in, or indeed as the doctor, probably sort of in his sort of tall hat and tailcoat, running over the field to come and diagnose some sort of crisis or trouble in your subject's life. So in a way, you say that this involves a kind of slight but complex sense of guilt for you, that there you are sort of perhaps importing this kind of drama to make your subject's life more interesting. How do you break off your imaginative engagement to stop biography becoming fiction?
There is a diagnostic. There's also clearly a detective element. You're trying, in the sense that every life, not that every life is a crime, but it's like it requires a solution.
A sleuth.
A sleuth and a solution all the time. So, yes, you have these various roles, and that's one, the detective. Yes, the tramp is the one I always often feel is, as a biographer, it's sort of rather awkward. What are they doing? What are you doing? Tapping on the window of someone's life. Let me in, I want to know more. That kind of feeling. Yeah. And I think that's very proper to feel that, the thing that you might be intruding. And therefore, the question of honesty and truth becomes very important of what you discover and what you see. What are the other elements you said to that?
On the one hand, you want to kind of create a biography which gives the living effect, but stays true to the dead fact. Mm. But in generating the living effect, you're involved in all of these processes which involve you in a kind of a strange set of kind of imaginative, kind of empathetic relationships with your characters, which sometimes are the effect almost of a poltergeist in their lives. This is what I'm proposing to you to sort of disentangle for me.
Yes. I mean, it is that sense of the biographer living in the time of their subject's life. When I'm on the whole writing about the Romantic period, so it's that thing. And also being in your own life. It is quite complicated the way that goes. Again, I remember a very early thing, writing a cheque and dating it. I think it's 3rd September 1772. I forget how the bank dealt with this, but they did. So yes, there's strange distortions, but of course this obviously happens to fiction writers as well, who live in their own world.
Yes, how do you stop the process of kind of generating biographical writing from becoming the same as imaginative fiction?
Yes. Yeah.
How do you make that distinction?
One of the answers partly the theme of Footsteps is exactly about that. is being drawn into stories and then having to step back out of them.
Much as you mark the beginning of your career as a biographer from that bounced check when you're not in the 1900s but the 1700s, there's a process that you describe very well about feeling yourself becoming, you say, thin, unreal, beginning to be invisible in this kind of chase of past lives, of ghosts. You also say that you couldn't see yourself properly. But that had an enormously liberating effect on you, becoming the sort of drifting tramp, half-ghost figure, that it meant that you could socially talk to anyone, because you somehow kind of were no longer anchored in your own social inhibitions.
Yeah, it's that's right. Quite interesting to describe. Again, this is very much the effect of when you're travelling, when you're pursuing your subject. My biographers had taken me, well, all over Europe anyway, and also Scotland, Ireland, down to Malta and Italy, and so on. And when you're travelling as in research, you're not like an ordinary tourist or something. You certainly don't feel like that, because you're all the time trying to find out this, go back to this other place, this other time. And it has the effect that, yes, you become sort of invisible. And it does have a kind of, I'm prepared to ask anybody about anything. Do you know this? Can you help me with that? In a way that if you were an ordinary traveller, I wouldn't feel like that. So it is a curious effect.
I was really struck how well people respond to you as this kind of drifting, rather admirable kind of character in search of the past and in some way of the past. They facilitated you as best they could. They understand that you are off with your ghosts.
Yes.
And the only thing they occasionally give you, I think some Irish friends of yours, is a little warning of don't let them steal you away entirely.
Again, going back to the very early trip, which is in the first part of Footsteps, when I'm going down the south, I get a hitchhike in a van to the village I'm going to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to explain in my, at that point, very bad French to the van, who's a winemaker, what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, you know, I'm looking for Robert Louis Stevenson. And they say, oh, what, is he a friend of yours? And I said, well, yes. Is he living here? Well, no. And you gradually go back to the idea he's someone who was here but 100 years ago. And to explain that is quite difficult, actually. And it was only, I think, in that case, I was able to show him the map in the book, and that he understood from this map, oh, it was someone who'd made this journey, and you're following in the footsteps, hence the title, finally.
Let me follow up on that, to stay with you as a kind of character in search of lives 200 years ago, and people encounter you, a bit like Blanche Dubois, you know, sort of relying on the kindness of strangers. They understand that there you are, kind of in this kind of past period. Insofar as you are 200 years ago, tracking through Italy or France, does that give you an unusual insight into the present? I mean, you say at one point that researching kind of Shelley and his circle gave you a key to understanding the events in France in May 68. What could you say to that?
Yes, there were. I mean, in that course, there were great echoes of what was happening in the Les Événements in Paris. And it had various sort of harmonic relations to what had happened during the revolution. And then my people going down there, Mary Wollstonecraft, particularly Wordsworth was there as well, and then Shelley in The Next Generation, this sense of what, the hope. The thing, it is interesting, it's a thing that we've almost lost at the moment, the idea of a sort of revolutionary hope that will change society for everybody. We need to get back to that. Perhaps it is coming back in some different way. But I felt that very strongly when I was writing the book, and that there was this kind of one, I think I called it more a haunting than a history, and that Shelley's life was like that. The other thing I think I want to say is all what we've been talking about is this very early book, Footsteps.
Yes.
And it's an account of my very my beginnings as a biographer and my initial sense of what I was trying to do in Discovery. And of course, for the later books about courage and about the age of wonder and about balloonists, all that, then they are, in a sense, more sophisticated books. And why I do actually still rather treasure Footsteps is precisely because it is rather naive. And because it's got these very simplistic ideas about being haunted, being carried away, becoming invisible, to have this conversation with your character. This is very much written out of someone who is 18, 20, learning the business, the craft, the art, well, I call it the vocation of biography.
A book I would recommend to anyone setting out to become a biographer, I must say. Michael Holroyd calls it a modern masterpiece, and in that sense I think it very much is. But before we leave, I'd like to ask a couple of technical questions. Mm. First of all, the past subjunctive. You mentioned this as a tense, almost, that the biographer must sort of begin to master the capacity to relive the past as if it had been as they hoped and imagined.
Yes, it is very important. I remember long after writing a long essay, really, Chili Andral, I think it was called, and what it does is try to look at all the hopes that he had that he was never able to fulfil. And suppose he hadn't drowned, would his life have been like? Would he have gone back to England? Would he have been involved, for example, with the new formation of the London University, an agnostic institution which would appeal to him, poetry and politics altogether. He was fascinated by science, so he would write odes to electricity or whatever it would be. So that sense of knowing what your subjects dreamt about and wanted and hoped to achieve but never made it, and that's the subjunctive. That tense you need to know and understand, I think, about your people.
Another technique, co-opting a contemporary of your subject, co-opting their view of the subject in a way to question and challenge our own received views.
Yes. I think I said someplace, all biographical evidence is third-party evidence. And the more witnesses you can assemble to a particular event or a particular person, how differently they struck their contemporaries, that's very, very important. So when you get two, as it were, large biographical masses, Keats and Shelley, when they meet and what they make of each other, which is quite complicated, that tells you a great deal. Or, for example, when Keats meets the older Coleridge wandering up Hampstead Heath, and Coleridge holds forth this long monologue that the young Keats is able to record. And it's a great list of things, which incidentally includes ghosts. There suddenly you get a kind of binocular, trinocular view, and all the time you're trying to do that so that you bring your subject alive with often contradictory views of who they are. They themselves contradict each other. I always say, with Coleridge's wonderful notebooks, a great example is one evening in 1812, he's going through a sort of breakdown, really, and he writes his confession of how terrible things are, what can he still believe in, and how desperate everything is. His friendship with Wordsworth has broken down. This long confessional note. The same evening, he goes out and he dines with Charles Lamb and the group. And Charles Lamb, his great friend, records, "Oh, Coleridge was there, looking well brushed and powdered, in fine form, and reciting his poetry." So you get these two completely contradictory things of what was happening inside Coleridge and outside him on the same evening.
Further technique, what you call a central interpretive consciousness, something borrowed from, you say, from the novelist Henry James, to produce a biographical group portrait. Is that still a technique?
Yes. Now, I remember this came up because when I was in Paris, I got fascinated by the photographs of Félix Nadal, who I have written about subsequently. And he, because of his amazing circle of people he knew, all the painters and composers and poets of the day, and of whom he photographed, And then he wrote notes about them. So he was like this central consciousness, seeing, constructing the group of his generation, including people like Hugo or Baudelaire or Nerval. And they're all there, all photographed, and then his notes in them. Photograph another haunting Nerval, taken possibly 48 hours before he killed himself, his last known, almost the only known photograph, which has a, and then Nadar's notes on that. So he would be an example of a central consciousness. And of course, by comparison, the biographer themselves has to become a sort of central consciousness, particularly when you're writing a book like The Age of Wonder, which is a group biography.
Of science in the Romantic period.
Yes, in the Romantic period.
A last technical question. The role of photography now in capturing modern lives, you know, in the case of Nadar, it would be sort of the bad complexions and poor diets of these sort of bohemian, sort of underpaid writers. What change has photography made, do you think, to the process of generating biography?
Yes, it's very interesting. When there's an absolute sharp moment when photography arrives, it's somewhere around between 1840 and 1850, and suddenly there's a generation. For example, there are no photographs of Shelley, but there are of his son, and there are of old De Quincey. There are none of Byron. So that dividing line, which is, you know, is that the division between a sort of ancient and modern in a curious way? I think it is very striking. Of course, more and more now, what we're touching here on a much bigger question, which is the whole, not merely photography, but electronic media, digital media, how that enormously is going to affect the kind of archives you have on someone. So the letters, there may be many less written letters, but many more email letters, blogs, interviews now may be filmed. The kind of resources a biographer has are altering, and they've altered it hugely in my lifetime. So it's not just the modern photograph, it's everything that is now in electronic media that's altered it. And it may alter the kind of biography people want as well. It's an interesting question. The old form of the literary biography, maybe that's just belongs to a particular period. I do think we had a great period really after the Second War of literary biography, a particular kind of biography, and it may alter now. It may change.
I have two concluding questions. The first, you observe the past is not something out there, but inside us, capable of being continually reimagined and represented. Is this also your view of history?
I think it's certainly my view of biography, in that biography itself changes. There's a reason for saying that some of the great figures of biography, they need writing about each generation, because the kind of questions we bring back to their lives alter depending on what's happened to us. It's one of my things that as an actual written biographer gets older, and itself moves away into the past, the presence of the biographer becomes more and more clear. So when you get Boswell writing about Johnson, it's now Boswell we see as much as Johnson. And there's this extraordinary, that biography is a sort of literary rule about this. Biography becomes more and more autobiographical as it gets older, as we move away. So it's very complex, the way memory changes and history changes, and it's certainly very complicated in the way that the forms of biography change and our ways of looking back change, which is one of the reasons it's such a great form to work in.
Finally, you track in Gérard de Nerval a turn in Romanticism from an outward social, political, imaginative adventure to an inward psychological journey which took you to the limits of biography, in the sense that you'd have to become a psychiatrist to be able to distinguish between hallucination and autobiography, or the overflowing of dreams into real life. Yes. I think perhaps again of Shelley, the real and imaginary colliding in his life, in his mind, when he cries out for meeting his double, strangling his wife. But you also, within this very early book on your adventures as a biographer, give an account of the biographer losing the plot. Does this vocation come with risks?
Yes, this is the last section of the Footsteps book, Nerval. And Nerval goes mad in various ways of describing this. He's actually in an asylum and so on. And his accounts of his own life get madder and madder. And as you go into that, they're more and more moving, and they're intensely poetical. But in trying to make biographical sense of them, you're being drawn into this crazed world. And there's only a point, so far can you go. The last scene in Footsteps is my dear friend Sylvie says to me, we're sitting, which place we're in, but she says, I think, Richard, it is time you went home, i.e. step back into your own life, and now you can write about all this. So that's, anyway, it's the early account, the young biographer.
Richard Holmes, thank you for talking to us.
It's been a pleasure.
That was Richard Holmes in conversation with Gabriel Badamosi. You can find out more about Richard on Wikipedia. And that concludes episode 311, which was recorded by Gabriel Badamosi and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 312, Amanda Dalton speaks with Amanda Whittington about teaching, poetry and drama, and silent film on the radio. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.